Hi, everybody. Scott made one big mistake. So did Mary. The real heroes are the people who are practicing primary care day in and day out, decade after decade, to take care of people in the United States. Those are the people who should get applause. Thank you. All it takes is like one wave of the hand. So what are we going to talk about today? Can everyone hear me, by the way? Primary care's dilemmas, learning from the bright spots, bright spot primary care teams, and teaching practices. And the key thing here is, what are these dilemmas that are facing primary care? Because I've kind of tried to figure out over the years what the dilemmas are. And I think there are three of them, and they're all interrelated. Number one, many patients lack prompt access because there are not enough primary care clinicians. When I use the word clinician today, I'm going to mean physicians, nurse practitioners, and PAs. The number of primary care clinicians is insufficient to meet the population's demand for care, and that's going to continue. So that's one issue. The second is that we face high levels of burnout, and we can't add additional capacity to see more patients. Now, primary care teams that empower team members to share responsibility and really add capacity, that could help with these both of these dilemmas, because we could see more patients without increasing physician stress. And we're going to get back to whether or not teams can really do that over the course of the next period of time. But then there's another problem. Patients really want a trusting relationship with a physician. Are they willing to transfer that trusting relationship to a team? Because if we need teams to add capacity without increasing physician burnout, are patients going to accept that model? Excuse me. So the challenges really are prompt access for patients, physician well-being, and the continuous trusting relationships with patients. And can we do all those things at the same time? So again, so just to review what the questions are, can teams add capacity to see more patients? Can teams reduce burnout? And will patients accept teams? And we're going to get back to those questions in a few minutes, but I want to do some background first, and then we're going to go back to these three questions. Everyone with me so far? So the projected demand, excuse me, for generalist physicians is that demand is going to increase a lot. The supply of primary care physicians, which is family docs, general internists, and general pediatricians, is going down. So the gap is tremendous. And there are different people who project what the gap is. One of the projections is 17,000 primary care physicians short by 2025. Now, will nurse practitioners and PAs close that gap? So there are about 1,400 new nurse practitioners coming out of school every year and about 6,000 PAs. And about half of the nurse practitioners and about a third of the PAs go into primary care. But if you add up the new general internists, family docs, nurse practitioners, and PAs entering primary care each year, and we're talking about adult now, not pediatrics, which is not in such bad shape, if we add those people up, we're going to take care of our adults. Thank you, Scott. The primary care clinician to population ratio is still going to fall. So there's definitely a shortage of people to take care of our population. Burnout. There are a number of studies of burnout. This one was 27%. Of general internists and family docs are burning out, and 30% are likely to leave a practice within 2 years. When I was in private practice for 22 years, I had times when I was so stressed out that I just wanted to leave and never come back. Now, I also had times of wonderful joy. So burnout is one of these things that kind of comes and goes. But it's very devastating if people are really burned out and they do want to leave, and patients suffer when physicians are burned out. panel sizes in the United States are too big. So I think some of you have heard this research that was done at Duke, which is a primary care clinician with a panel of 2,000 average patients will spend 6 hours doing all recommended preventive care, plus 8.5 hours doing all recommended chronic care. That's every day if they don't have a team. So it's not really possible to do this without a team. Okay, let's get to the patient part. Like, will patients accept teams? Well, the first question is, what do patients want from physicians? And there's quite a bit of interesting research about this. Patients, I want my physician to have the knowledge needed to help me, competence. I want my physician to care about me, empathy. I want to know my physician, and I want my physician to know me. And I want to see my personal physician when I need help. That's what patients want out of us. So the question is, can we build teams that allow non-physicians to provide these four patient needs while adding capacity and reducing clinician burnout? Okay, we've talked about the dilemmas. Now I want to talk a little bit about the way I really learn things, which is from the bright spots. You know, a lot of us feel like, well, we learn things from randomized controlled trials. And we all do. But the way I've learned in the last 10 or 15 years when I've really been trying to think about primary care is I've learned from places that work really well. So there's an interesting example of this. An organizer went to Vietnam to help reduce childhood malnutrition maybe 15, 20 years ago. And the government said, you have 6 months to take care of the problem, which was, of course, ridiculous. So what was the strategy? Well, he went to rural villages and he asked all the mothers to weigh their kids. And then he said, which of the mothers who are really poor have kids who are well-nourished? And what are they doing that the other mothers are not doing? Figured out what they were doing, and then he organized the high-performing mothers to spread their practices to the families with malnourished kids. And it worked. This is from Chip and Dan Heath, How to Change Things When Change is Hard. It's a very nice book. So learning from the bright spots. So this organizer found the bright spots and arranged for the bright spots to illuminate the dark corners. And in primary care, I hate to say it, there are dark corners. But there are also bright spots. And of course, there's everything in between. But going to the bright spots and finding out how they work really can help. And there are really three levels of bright spots: practices, individuals, and teams. So we, along with some colleagues outside of UCSF, we went to 23 practices that had been labeled by people who are kind of familiar with primary care as being good practices. And they're all over the country, and there are many different kinds of practices. And there are many practices that are bright spots we didn't go to. So if you're not on this list, don't feel bad. You're probably also a bright spot. The interesting thing we found is that even though from the outside these practices looked very different, some were FQHCs, some were in big integrated delivery systems, some were small private practices, etc. From the outside they looked different, from the inside they all looked very similar. And so what we did was we took the common characteristics of these excellent practices and we put them together into what we call the building blocks of high-performing primary care. Now, I'm not going to talk about all the building blocks today because that's a whole different discussion. I would invite you to read our Annals of Family Medicine article to learn more about the building blocks. We're going to specifically talk about building block number 4, which is teams. Now, toward the end of this presentation, I'm going to talk some about teaching clinics because a lot of you, of course, are involved with teaching clinics. These visits were to non-teaching clinics. But since then, we've done over 20 separate visits to primary care teaching clinics in pediatrics, internal medicine, and family medicine. And I'll be talking about that a little bit later. They have all of the same issues multiplied by 10. teaching clinics are very, very difficult. This is not a map of the places we went. It's very interesting that the teaching health center programs often were the bright spots. So we'll get back to teaching clinics later. Now I want to talk about bright spot primary care teams. What does a good team look like? And then we're going to get back to talk about these three dilemmas that we're talking about and how teams can actually do something about them. The first thing is that how many of you work with a team? Almost everybody. How many of you think it's really easy to form a good team? Is that a leading question or not? So teams are difficult, as this cartoon says. If we want to succeed as a team, we need to put aside our own selfish individual interests and start doing things my way. So I want to ask a series of questions. Raise your hand if the team that you work with, that any team members independently take care of patients without a clinician being involved, like a nurse or a behavioral health person or a pharmacist or an MA, how many someone else actually really does something for the patients? That's pretty good. I've been in rooms where total silence. So they have teams, but the doctor still does everything. So it sounds like we're ahead of the curve. In how many cases did the team improve a quality measure over what a lone clinician could do? So for example, medical assistant doing panel management, we know there's excellent research that shows that they can improve rates of colon cancer screening, mammograms, people getting their diabetic process measures done, and so forth. In how many cases, raise your hand, did the team reduce the work of the clinician? Because there are teams that increase the work of the clinician. And those teams are called electronic health records. So really the question is, did the team add capacity to see more patients without causing more work for a clinician? And if the answer to all these questions is no, it didn't have better quality, it didn't reduce physician stress and work, it didn't add capacity, then it's probably not worth having the team. Because I think a lot of us feel like everyone's telling us we need teams, but there has to be a reason why we have teams, and they have to be able to do these functions. So what we found in the the high-performing practices is that there are some characteristics of high-performing teams. This is not one of them. It's an interesting book, though. Number one is a stable team structure. Co-location, I'm going to talk about those two in a minute. Culture shift to share the care. Defined roles with training and skills checks. Standing orders, defined workflows, staffing ratios adequate to allow new roles to actually happen. Ground rules and communication, including huddles. I want to talk about some of these because it's sort of the substrate for answering the key questions that we have today, which has to do with capacity, physician stress, and patient acceptance. And really, in a way, the most important is the team structure. You know, a lot of us talk about the key to a team is communication. Well, yes, communication is, of course, extremely important. But I would go out on a limb and say the key to a team is a stable team structure. So let me ask another question. How many of you work on teams or associated with teams in which on different days, some people have to go work on a different team? That's a very common problem, that the teams are not stable. So let's talk about stable team structure. And I want to first talk about teamlets. Some people call them dyads. This is sort of the traditional clinician, medical assistant, people always working together. And in a non-teaching practice, what we found is that a majority of the practices that we visited, the high-performing practices, had a teamlet structure in which a clinician would always work with the same MA. And the patient panel would be impaneled to that clinician and MA. Now, around some of these dyads, these small teamlets, would be a larger team in which there'd be other people who would be available for patients that needed more. So an RN, complex care manager, for example, a behavioral health person, social worker, health coach, pharmacist, would be around several teamlets. So we saw this in a number of practices, a team model with small teamlets surrounded by a larger team. Now, if you look at a teaching practice model, that's not going to work because residents and often faculty are not in clinic very often, so you can't have the same clinician and the same MA constantly working together. So there are many varieties of this in teaching practice, and just to show you an example, this would be like a patient panel of 1,200, and the continuity figure is a nurse practitioner or a PA who works with a medical assistant or an LVN or LPN, and that patient panel is subdivided into four sub-panels of 300, and each resident has a sub-panel of 300 that they co-manage with the nurse practitioner PA. And then so that's like a academic practice teamlet, and around these teamlets there can be other supportive personnel. But, you know, there are many different varieties of these, and there are actually many different varieties of teamlets in non-teaching practices too. So what do we mean by stable? Number one, the same people always work together. Always. You never work on a different team. Number two, the patients impaneled to the team or the teamlet always see that team or teamlet. And that team or teamlet doesn't ever see patients from another team or teamlet. Those are the key things about stability. And, you know, for patients, it's really, really important that they get to know their team and that when they need care, they see their team. They don't get shunted off to a different team. So team stability is very critical. And it sounds simple, but it's not. And often the scheduling concerns lead practices to have people work on different teams, to have patients be seen by different teams. And in a well-run practice in which the leadership is really bought into the key importance of a stable team, team stability trumps scheduling convenience. Is that easy to do? Not at all. Okay, back to patients. Will patients accept teamlets? Are teamlets a good idea for trying to have patients transfer their trust from an individual clinician to a team? There's really good research that shows that patients like small practices. And what teamlets do is they break up a large or a medium-sized practice into smaller entities that patients can feel comfortable with. So it feels more like that old GP practice, family practice, where you knew the receptionist, you knew the MA, you knew the doc, and you felt just okay walking into that office, as opposed to many of our practices now that are much larger. But you can make that practice seem smaller by having a teamlet model. Patients get to know and trust their teamlets, and so forth. In a very small practice, you don't have that nurse care manager or behavioral health person to support the teamlets, but you often have a hospital around or an IPA or a health plan who can provide that support for your teamlets. Okay, we've talked about stable teams. The second characteristic of high-performing practices that we've seen is co-location. How many of you work in teams that are co-located, that everyone works together in one space? Good, that's not bad. You guys were co-located yesterday. Co-location is, how many of you have seen practices that are co-located, visited one? I just love co-located practices. So this is like the pod at Clinica Family Health Services in Colorado. So they have this big space, and the space has workstations in which the doctor and the MA teamlet sit right next to each other. So they're constantly talking to each other throughout the day. And then the support people, like an RN, social worker, health coach, are also in that space. And so there are three teamlets and the support personnel in that one space, and they work together constantly. And I've seen this in academic practices also. There's actually some interesting research that shows that co-location increases team collaboration and coordination. And what a lot of people have said is, if we actually change the architecture, it makes us realize that, you know what, we are in teams now. It has a psychological impact also into the practice. Now, doctors, you know, well, we're going to take away your private office, you're going to be in this pod with everyone else. And no, that's not happening with me. I'm not doing that. But then I haven't found one place where the doctors didn't like it once it got started. It can be done by not changing the architecture. So, for example, we have a practice in San Francisco in which, you know, the doctors were over here at one end of the hall and the MAs were over here at the other end of the hall. So what the practice manager did is she created teamlets, and then she said, half of the MAs are going over here and half of the doctors are going over here, and we've co-located. Can be done. Culture shift, share the care. So remember, you can't add capacity unless other people on the team are actually seeing patients independently. Now, we believe that sharing the care does not delegating. We don't like the word delegating. You know, doctors, we love the word delegating. We're going to delegate this to the RN. We're going to delegate this to the MA. Think of yourself as being the MA or the RN. Here's this doctor who makes three times as much money as I do, in the case of an MA, telling me to do more work so that they can do less work. Not okay. So we use sharing, reallocating responsibilities. And actually, there's a big difference between delegating a task, which is like do an EKG or do a blood glucose on this patient, and reallocating responsibilities. So responsibility would be, okay, we have a patient panel, we're in a teamlet together. How would it be if we train you to be responsible to make sure that this patient panel has all of its chronic and preventive care tasks done on a timely basis? So basically the medical assistant becomes the panel manager. And then the medical assistant has responsibility for the panel of patients, not just delegating tasks. And they're much more likely to say, okay, let's do it. Now, will all doctors be willing to share responsibility? And will all RNs and MAs be willing to take on the responsibility? Of course not. So you start with the bright spots, the enthusiastic people who want to do it. So when we go into practices, we have this little form, which is called Share the Care, Who Does It Now? These are all a bunch of, you know, typical things that we do in primary care, ordering mammograms, caring for people with uncomplicated UTIs, prescribing statins, doing med rec, and so forth. And we ask people, who does that? And most of the practices, the doctor does all of it. And then we do have another one, which is share the care, who could do it? And then really brainstorming, like, who could do all of these things if they're trained, if it's in their scope of practice, if they have time, and so forth. So sharing the care is a big part of having a team that can actually increase capacity to see more patients. Okay, we've talked about some of the elements. I'm just going to talk about a couple more. I'm not going to do all of them. Standing orders and staffing ratios. So standing, you can't share the care without standing orders. I mean, RNs cannot independently do things. Pharmacists increasingly are able to do them, but you really need standing orders to empower non-clinicians to actually independently see patients. How many of you have standing orders in your practices? It's just amazing. Like 2 or 3 years ago, I'll bet you a third of you would have raised your hands. Things are moving in a good direction that way. A really problematic one is staffing ratios. You can't share the care without adequate staff. So if you look at the VA has what they call teamlets. Their teamlet is a clinician, an RN, an LPN or LVN, and a clerk. They have four-person teamlets, so they actually can share the care much easier. But if you look at primary care overall, what percent of the healthcare dollar does primary care get? About 5%. It's ridiculous. It is so little, so that you can't really hire adequate staff to share the care enough. There are bright spot examples. So Group Health in Seattle received 13, the primary care received 13% of the healthcare dollar back a few years ago. Sadly, that seems to be going backward now in group health. So the average staffing in the US is something like 2.68 staff per physician. And an interesting paper says to implement patient-centered medical home requires 4.25 staff per physician. So not having enough staff is definitely a big problem. And our belief is that insurers and provider organizations should give 10 to 12% to primary care. And a very interesting metric, but I have not found anybody who actually measures this, is what percent of the healthcare dollar goes to primary care in your organization? It'd be a very interesting thing to find out. Okay, back to the three questions. Can teams add capacity? Can they reduce burnout? And will patients accept teams? So in order to add capacity, you have to share the care. And I'm going to give two examples of how you can share the care to increase capacity to see more patients without increasing physician stress. One of them is scribes, and one of them is reallocation for sub-panels of patients to RNs, pharmacists, and physical therapists. Now, the first thing that comes to most people's mind when people talk about these things is the barriers. Fee-for-service payment doesn't reimburse non-clinicians, takes too much time to train people, scope of practice, physicians don't accept it, not enough staff to do it. What I'd beg you to do is don't think about the barriers yet. Think about what is possible. Barriers will paralyze us from doing anything. Do we have to deal with the barriers at some point? Absolutely. But first, figure out what you want to do, and then try to figure out how you can actually make it happen. So University of Utah has a really wonderful MA scribe program. They've had it for over 10 years. So the medical assistant, who's well-trained, goes into the visit, does the history using templates. Then the physician comes in. The medical assistant stays there, is sitting at the Epic computer. MD quickly reviews the history, does the physical exam, calls out the findings. The MA enters them into the computer. The doc calls out the lab, imaging, pharmacy. MA enters them. The doc just has to press one button. It all gets sent off to happen. Doctors see more patients, capacity goes up, and go home earlier, burnout goes down. Revenue went up, patient satisfaction went up, provider satisfaction went up, quality measures went up. Another very interesting one is a small pilot study of scribes at UCLA, which Dave Rubin did. This was two scribes, they call them physician partners. What they found was that in a four-hour clinic session, having these scribes saved 75 minutes of physician time by doing the documentation right there. 79% of the patients were satisfied having the scribe in the room, and patients were more likely to report that the physician spent enough time with them. Isn't that interesting? The physician spent less time with them, but the patients felt they spent more time with them because the physician wasn't talking to the computer. So scribes is one way. It's a team, a change, a team that can add capacity to see more patients and reduce physician burnout. Okay, the other thing we were going to talk about is reallocating a responsibility for certain patients. So let's just do a hypothetical. Let's assume you have a panel of 2,000 patients, that each patient on average comes 3 times a year, so you have 6,000 visits a year. And just for fun, let's say 1,000 of the patients have diabetes, or the visits, not the patients, 1,000 of the visits are diabetes, 1,000 are hypertension, and 1,000 are uncomplicated low back, knee, and shoulder pain. And let's assume that RNs, pharmacists, and physical therapists can independently care for 2/3 of those 3,000 visits with those diagnoses. So that means that the non-clinician visits is 2,000, which means that the clinicians are actually seeing 4,000 visits a year rather than 6,000. So they could either see more patients because now they have more time, or their burnout would be reduced. Now, those numbers, those are just made up numbers, but you get the idea. So can this actually happen? Is there evidence that shows that these things can happen? This was a randomized controlled trial of RNs taking care of people with diabetes and elevated blood pressure, and the patients with RN management, including initiating meds and titrating doses, because they had standing orders to do that, were 3 times more likely to reach their blood pressure goal than physician management. Now again, does that mean the RNs are better than the physicians? No, it means they have more time, but that they're good. Pharmacists, this was a randomized controlled trial of total pharmacist management of hypertension, including medications. At 18 months, 72% blood pressure control for pharmacist care, 57% for doctors. Again, this was the only thing the pharmacist had to deal with in the visit rather than the 7.1 average items that doctors have to deal with in the average visit. Physical therapy. Patients with uncomplicated musculoskeletal injuries who directly access physical therapists have better outcomes and so forth, lower costs. So go to the physical therapist first, and there are actually some state laws that are now allowing this. And then if there are red flags, the physical therapist will send it to the physician. Makes total sense. And just think of all the visits that are with these kind of complaints. And then behaviorists working as depression care managers have better depression outcomes compared with physician-only care and reduces number of physician visits. So all of these things are evidence-based to have good quality and to add capacity without additional physician work. And then, of course, you have complex care management, where you can have RNs, nurse practitioners, or PAs as complex care managers, which can improve care, cut costs, and reduce clinician time. Back to the barriers for a second. Is there a business case for doing any of this? So under fee-for-service, of course, this is the problem. Where you only get paid for a doctor, nurse practitioner, or PA visits. We know that saving physician time with the SCRIBE program allows physicians to see 1 to 2 extra patients per day. And actually, that can pay for, in many places, for one additional full-time medical assistant. And for RN visits, a number of people are doing co-visits in which the RN is doing 80-90% of the visit and the doctor comes in at the end so that you can bill. And in most places, this is fine because the patient's getting good care, it's well documented, and so forth. Then there are payments on top of fee-for-service, which is pay for performance. RN's doing Medicare annual wellness visits and Medicare chronic care management visits, which are not so simple, but they're a possibility. PCMH, additional payments. So payments on top of fee-for-service can help you to hire more people. It helps your business case. And then non-fee-for-service, capitation or shared savings, decouples payment from visits. So the business case is very challenging, but a number of places have found that they could add like a scribe or add an RN care manager and can actually do okay financially. Just a few words on teams and burnout. The less time clinicians do tasks below their level of training, the lower the burnout. We like to do things that only we are capable of doing. We also know that if nursing personnel take histories, stay in the visit to document care, arrange lab, imaging, pharmacy, physicians see more patients, more satisfied, increase revenues, go home earlier. And we've talked about the situation with Dave Rubin at UCLA. That saves a lot of time so you could see more patients and pay for that scribe. We did some work with clinician satisfaction with teams, and what we found was that if physicians worked with a stable teamlet, the same MA all the time, they were 70% satisfied. If they worked with a group of MAs, 37% satisfied, and no team at all, 11% satisfied. So a stable team actually can improve physician satisfaction. We also looked at, in teams that have a reasonable team culture where people get along well with each other, if you have no team, your exhaustion mean score, and the exhaustion is part of the Maslach burnout inventory, is almost 5, whereas if you have a stable teamlet, it's down to about 3. So burnout seems to go down if you have a stable teamlet, that you're working with the same person all the time. And also, if you have a medical assistant that's doing your panel management, so if they're responsible for making sure people get their immunizations, if it's in a teamlet situation, clinicians are much more confident that the MA will do a good job. than if you don't have a team at all. It's the same thing for cancer screening and diabetes process measures. So a stable teamlet is associated with lower burnout. Okay, patients and teams. So again, we talked about these things that patients want from physicians, and the question is, can they get this from a team? There's some research on this, but this really needs a lot more research. What it looks like is that patients will accept teams if the teams are visible, if the patients are always cared for by their own team, if they're small, and if patients know their team members and the team members know their patients. Interesting survey of in California, 81% of households surveyed said they're willing to accept care from a team even if it means seeing the physician less. And there's also some research showing that patients can trust nurses, physical therapists, and pharmacists if they show empathy and if the patients view them as competent. So again, small teams, which the patients are familiar with the teams, they know the teams and the teams know them, it can work. Okay. A little bit about teaching practices, because this is, after all, STFM. So the unique considerations about teaching practices is that faculty, physicians, and residents spend only 1 to 2 half days in teaching clinics, so there's challenges with continuity, access, and teams. So here you have, in the traditional model, you have a resident seeing a different MA every time they're in the clinic. In a teamlet model, stable teamlet model, whenever the resident number one is in the clinic, they work with MA number one. Same with resident number two and MA number two. So what that means is that it feels like a teamlet from the resident's point of view. They're always working with the same MA. Now the MA, over a week, is probably going to be working with 5 different residents. But from the resident point of view, it's a stable teamlet situation. Making this happen with scheduling is, of course, the challenge. Co-location can also work really beautifully in a teaching practice. So rather than the MAs in one room and the residents and the preceptors in another room, you can put them all in one room. The MA and the resident sit next to each other, and you have the attendings and then the other members of the team. And I've seen this, and it works really, really well. So creating teams and residency teaching practices really needs a new residency paradigm. So if you have the typical hospital first, clinic second paradigm, which is the schedules are first what the hospital needs, and then the clinic gets kind of the leftovers, so that you have, like on a Monday, you might have 8 residents, and on a Tuesday, you might have 2 residents. You can't have stable teams that way. It doesn't work. A different philosophy is clinic first, that ambulatory learning is a top priority, that you want an operationally excellent clinic, and that the curriculum for the residents is the clinic. That is the curriculum, both the medical part of it and the how do you work in a well-organized system. Now, this requires the clinic-first philosophy requires some big changes in just how you set up a residency program and the residency teaching clinic. You have to prioritize the clinic teams as really crucial, because when a resident comes into a clinic, if they don't know what team they're going to be on, they're just in this big sort of thing. If they know that I'm going to be on the red team, I'm always on the red team, I always work with the same MA, it's like a patient having a stable team. It feels comfortable to have a stable team for residents also. So that's all about scheduling to make that happen. It also helps continuity of care, of course, with patients. Separating out inpatient and outpatient resident responsibilities. So rather than running from the inpatient in the morning to the clinic in the afternoon, which is disruptive to both the inpatient and the clinic, and means the resident has sort of divided loyalties and it's hard to concentrate on the clinic because they're worried about their patient in the hospital. If you separate them out and you never have them on the same day doing both things, it can really help. Now, there are different ways to do that. There's block schedules and there are other ways of doing it, but it's a principle that we found in high-performing teaching practices. And then finally, and this is a tough one, developing a small core of clinical faculty that cares about the clinic. Because if you're in the clinic half a day a week and what you really care about is all the other things you're doing if you're a faculty member, you don't care if the clinic's dysfunctional. You know, you can survive that for half a day a week. But if you have a core of clinical faculty that their professional life is the clinic, they're going to make sure that that clinic works well. And then they're also the continuity figures. They're the leaders of the teams. And the places that we've visited that had a core clinic faculty really seem to work the best. So this is major change to try to get these things to happen in a teaching clinic. So what have we done? With stable teams that share the care, we can meet patient demand without more clinician burnout. And we can care for our patients with competence and empathy and deserve the trust. And the trust can be a trust in the team. It's more difficult in resident teaching clinics, but we've visited ones that have done it. It can be done. Great primary care is a beautiful thing. Thank you.